Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. The pre-med year, session number 431. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for taking some time to join me today. Before we jump into our episode today, I want to let you know about the MCAT Minute, which is sponsored by Blueprint MCAT Prep. As you know, or maybe you don't, MCAT registration just opened if you're planning on taking the MCAT in these first few months of 2021, with more dates opening in the next few months. And I want you to let you know, if you haven't registered yet and you're planning to take the MCAT in March, April, or May, then you should go register as soon as you can. The MCAT is taken at testing centers that have limited seats available for each day the MCAT is offered. And the longer you prolong your registration, the higher the likelihood that you will have to travel far distances to take the MCAT on a date or within a certain time period that you want to take the MCAT. So if you haven't yet, go check out Blueprint's MCAT test dates over at blueprintprep.com/MCAT. See what dates are available and go register for the MCAT as soon as you can so that you reduce the burden of travel and expenses and stress needed to take the MCAT. That's our MCAT Minute, again, sponsored by Blueprint Prep. Go check them out, blueprintprep.com. All right, so today's episode was one where I wanted to give you the discussion that we had on Ask the Dean today, which is typically a private live Facebook Q&A that we do for our MAPT members. So if you're not familiar, MAPT is a software platform that I co-founded and have developed and released last year in 2020, that now more than 1,400 students are using to track their progress to medical school. And as part of a perk of a student being on that platform, there's a private Facebook group where we do live Q&As every Monday called Ask the Dean. And today's, I really went on some rants and we covered some really interesting topics and questions, and I want to play those for you today. The Ask the Deans, while they are live in this private Facebook group, we do have a podcast and a YouTube channel where we show them at a later date. So if you're interested and you want more Q&A like our episode today, you can subscribe to the Ask the Dean podcast. I'm behind on releasing episodes there. More will come out shortly. Or on our YouTube channel, mapt.tv. That's mappd.tv. You can find the recordings of our Facebook Lives there. And if you haven't checked out MAPT yet, go check it out. There's a free two-week trial available for you. You can enter your grades, see some beautiful graphs to help you decide if you're ready to apply to medical school or not. You can enter in your courses. You can enter in your activities, your MCAT scores. You can now start working on your applications inside of MAPT, including your extracurricular activities, your TMDSAS secondary or optional essay and required essay, all of your personal statements, depending on which application service you're applying to. Go check it all out. Free two-week trial at mapt.com. That's mapd.com. Let's go and jump into our Q&A today. First one up, I love when the question starts. I know Dr. Gray does not like this question, but is 113 hours of clinical experience as a medical assistant over 8 months, quote, enough? Check. I checked it off. Dr. Wright, is that enough?
You know what? I think I won't answer that directly. What I would like to say is, as we say with so many of these questions, it depends a little bit on other things in the application. But my feeling is that if there's some shadowing hours, if there's other things in the application, if 113 hours of clinical experience as a medical assistant over 8 months, if that's it, if that's all the student has got, I think that's maybe a little concerning to me, that it may not be what I would be looking for. I want a diversity of experiences. I certainly want to see a commitment to medicine. And if you think about it, 113 hours over 8 months.
It's 3.3 hours a week.
Yeah, that's not a whole lot.
I just did the math.
Yeah, that's not much over that long period of time. Now, my guess is that what I don't understand is, I thought medical assistant is a job.
Yeah.
And if that's your job and you're only working 113 hours over 8 months, that's a very part-time job, like super part-time job. So I guess what I would say is probably not what I would want to see. But again, it depends on what else is there as to what might mitigate that a little bit.
Yeah, I hate this question because it's like, is it hours 4 years ago? Is it, or 113 hours 4 years ago over 8 months? Is it 8 months past the submission of your application and you don't have any of the experiences to lean on? Is it eight months just prior? Like there are so many.
It's too many questions.
Questions here. And is that all you have? And if that's all you have, I would say no, it's not enough.
I agree. But you're right that question, just the question in and of itself, smacks of checking a box. Did I do enough to check the box?
Yeah.
And that's not a good mentality.
Nope. It is not. Let me tell you. So today I recorded 5 episodes of Application Renovation, which I'm trying really hard to only pick students who unfortunately didn't get into medical school or currently waitlisted or whatever, who have really good stats. Like the ones that I had today, they're like 3.6, 5.14, 3.7, 5.16. My last one that I just recorded before getting on with you all was 3.99 science GPA, 3.96 overall, 5.21 MCAT.
Ooh, wow. And they didn't get in?
Only 2 interviews and 0 acceptances, both waitlisted at both schools.
Wow.
And it's super clear as day in his application why that happened. And I can't reiterate it enough. And Scott, you know this, right? You saw this on the other end, but I see it on this side. You've seen it on both sides, actually, from the pre-L side and the med school side, is students who think that stats are all you need.
Yeah.
And that's all the med schools care about. And there are these students out here, and you can call it anecdotal if you want, but there are students out here who are amazing on paper stat-wise, who have zero idea, at least that they were able to communicate in their application, why they're doing this that medical schools won't touch with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. And I remember years ago, I had a student when I was on the undergrad side in pre-health advising where we she came in to see me. She sat down. Same kind of situation that you're just describing. Good numbers, great GPA. I can't remember if she had taken the MCAT yet or not. I seem to think maybe she had. But anyway, she had zero clinical experience. And when I raised that as an issue with her, she got super offended and actually, you know, complained to my bosses and stuff and you know, and that I was being unrealistic and that I was being this or that or whatever. Well, she eventually got some clinical experience. She did get into medical school and she did come back later and apologize and really express that that she sees now on the other end of things, kind of the bigger picture and stuff. And so I definitely think you're right, Ryan, that the issue is a big one, and medical schools really are trying to be holistic in their approach to these things and not be, you know, just centered in on the numbers. They're looking at what is your commitment to medicine? How do you illustrate that over a long-term experience or multiple experiences, and what does that mean to you, and what have those things meant to you? And that gets down to the so what versus the what kind of thing that we talk about all the time. And so you're exactly right, Ryan. It's not all about the numbers, and it really is an issue of mentality often.
Yeah.
All right, next question here. If I'm applying to both DO and MD school, should I make my personal statement for a COMAS answer why DO, or is why medicine sufficient? I wanted to use the same personal statement from AMCAS.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you my answer based on what a COMAS did. Please. I don't care if you want it. I'm giving it to you. based on what a COMAS did last year or 2 years ago now. They changed their essay length from 4,500 characters to 5,300 to match AMCAS.
AMCAS, yep.
In my mind, that action said, use the same essay.
Yep, yep.
The application doesn't specifically talk about osteopathic medicine.
Right.
In my new application book, I dig up all of the prompts and what they focus on. Secondary essays are where you will most likely talk about why osteopathic medicine. The personal statement is, why do you want to be a physician? And again, getting back to application renovation today, one of the applications I reviewed was for a student who applied to a COMAS and had one sentence in the application that said, osteopathic medicine. It was like, blah, 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 blah. And this is why I like osteopathic medicine. Just completely out of the blue. Didn't really fit with the rest of the context of the sentence, but just felt the need. Like, I have to mention osteopathic medicine. And that just made it worse, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, I think you're right that the secondary application is where that often, you know, where schools will want to explore those things and where the student will have an opportunity to explore those things in terms of osteopathic medicine and a commitment to that or a recognition of what it is all about and stuff like that. And obviously in the interview, that's going to come up at almost every osteopathic school. Now, you know, it's interesting. Allopathic schools, it's not going to come up at all. They're not going to say, why allopathic medicine?
Not osteopathic.
Right. Yep. But the osteopathic schools, it will definitely come up in an interview. But I think that I agree with you. I think that, even though the TMDSAS personal statement length is slightly shorter than the AMCAS and a COMAS length, almost, you should be able to use the same one for all three with a small adjustment on the TMDSAS one.
Yeah, that's what I tell students to do is write the 5,300 character one, and if you're applying to TMDSAS as well,
just
find
cut
300 characters to cut out.
Yeah,
there's usually some to cut out there.
Yeah.
While we're on this topic,
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's a, right, bringing up TMDSAS, you apply to MD and DO schools through TMDSAS with one personal statement.
Yes, that's correct. So. That's correct.
What I was going to say is, while we're on this topic, MAPT members, you can go into MAPT to the applications tab and look at the personal comments and personal statements prompts. I mean, you could also go create yourself a free account for AMCAS and ACOMAS, but it's baked right into MAPT now. So
yeah,
you can see how very similar those prompts are.
Yeah.
And honestly, how vague they are, you know,
yeah, like
they both offer some context, but the prompt yeah itself for AMCAS is use the
what
space
do you want
provided
to say? Yeah.
Yeah. Use the space provided to explain why you want to go to medical school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You the notice team, how it doesn't say use the space provided to show that you are good enough to be a physician. Yeah. Right. That's what most students interpret it as.
Yeah. Why medical school?
I think the TMDSAS one is a little bit more specific. But I think in general, you know, that doesn't change the reality that you should be able to use the same one for all three.
Yeah. And again, you can see word for word the prompts, yep, MAPT yep members.
On
so
MAPT
head on into applications and you'll see how similar they are.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
All right.
All right. I won't throw this next one. Oh, that's just the feedback on what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, a lot of comments. I guess, so circling back to our talk about clinical. So somebody wrote in, Dr. Wright spoke about commitment to clinical. What does it mean if I had 8 years of full-time clinical job, then took another 6 years of gap in everything? Okay. Is it fine to have about 4 weeks of clinical? Sounds like it's been off and on, but steady.
Hmm.
That's the way I read that.
If I had 8 years of full-time clinical job and then took another 6 years gap in everything that pre-med has to do due to personal reasons. I've about 3 years before application, it is fine to have 4 hours a week.
Going back to what we were mentioning earlier, like we said, 3.3 hours a week.
Yeah.
Like that yeah wasn't a knock on only 3.3 hours a week. It was a knock on 113 hours over 8 months, like that's all you have, that yeah just equals 3.3. Like if someone yeah for a long time has this extended commitment and then either life changes and need a new job or whatever that looks like, it's consistently getting 4 hours a week for, they said, what, 3 years away from applying?
Yeah, yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, the broader context that's available now helps with my answer and yours,
yeah,
you know, what you guys are all saying is, yeah, that the picture now is a little bit more clear. And I agree with you, Ryan.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I know it's tempting, right? Because you want rubrics, right? You guys want to hear numbers. You want to yeah hear metrics that you can say, I have accomplished.
Yep.
But that's not really what clinical is about. It's about showing a long-term commitment and interest in working with patients.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of ways to shape that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Scott. So I again, just because it's top of mind, this the same student I was talking about, this ACOMAS application earlier, he's an engineer, works full-time as an engineer, does have clinical experience, does have good clinical experiences, has been given feedback that he is not showing that he's committed to medicine because he's not quitting his full-time job where he probably makes a good amount of money to focus on healthcare-related things. And I told him, like, you don't need to quit your job. You don't need to go get a low-paying job as a scribe or an EMT right just to show that you're committed. Now, that's right not to say that maybe you work 30 hours a week instead of 40 as an engineer to give you a little bit more time for more clinical experience, but it's not an all or none thing. That's quitting your job. It doesn't make you go, oh, you're committed now. I see that.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I don't like the idea of forcing somebody to you know, change the entire reality of their life to make it fit into this sort of stereotypical picture of what somebody thinks a pre-med path should look like.
Yeah, particularly yeah one that assumes you're wealthy enough to not have income.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like that's the exactly exact right opposite of what we're about here.
Yeah. Yep. So I agree with you completely, Ryan and Rachel, you too, on that one.
All right. So changing topics.
What do you do? What do you do? How do you do? What do you do when you see yourself plateauing in MCAT studying? I've consistently held 509, 510 on the past few tests, and I'm wondering how to break through. I test March 26. Rachel, you're up.
Sounds like a Rachel question.
Yeah. All right. So first of all, you don't have to tell me, but ask yourself. I don't really care that you're getting 509, 510. I mean, that's great. Good job. What I want to know is what you're getting on each of your sections, right? So I've mentioned this many times. I'll continue to mention it. If you go to the Blueprint MCAT blog, they've got an article that my old colleague Brian Schnedeker wrote like 7 or 8 years ago that's still true. It's called How Do I Know? Am I Ready to Take the MCAT? And it walks you through doing analysis of your last 4 or 5 practice tests and looking at the average of the section scores. So that's sort of step one, is get away from the composite and look at the up and down patterns by section. And then if you're plateauing at a number that, you know, is pretty good, I respect that you want more, you've got a month, no reason not to shoot for more, then you need to be diving way deeper than just your section score, right? You need to be looking at every question, whether you got it right or wrong. So it might take you 1 to 2 times as long to review your MCAT as it took you to take it. So if you're at the point a month from your MCAT, my guess is you're probably done with content. You're probably done with drilling sections. You're probably just taking full lengths at this point. You might only have time to take one a week because you spend 8 hours taking the exam and then another 8 to 15 hours reviewing it each week. And really looking at every question, whether you got it right or wrong, what the takeaway is. And, you know, depending on the company you're using for your prep, you may have some detailed analysis to look at that'll show you breakdown by critical reasoning skill or topic. And you need to start zeroing in on both the tiny little things you're still getting wrong, but also anything you're getting right when it comes to critical reasoning, how you can apply that to other questions. Mm-hmm. Hope that helps.
Yeah. Good answer.
Good, good.
And to not freak out about plateaus, right? They're there. Uh-huh. They happen.
Yeah, they're normal. And honestly, you might go down again. I mean, I'm not trying to jinx you, but that is, most progress looks like this before it goes up, you know? So if you get a 507, you might get a 512 next time. And again, go back to those section scores.
Yeah. All right. My second favorite question here. Oh, how do you interpret medical school or MCAS stats in the sense that we have access to information regarding median MCAT and GPA scores? So hypothetically, if our GPA falls below a median GPA score, let's say the median is 3.96 for the school. Oh, Lord. Then yeah. Are students already at a disadvantage applying to the school with a GPA MCAT below median? Obvious letters of rec, research, extracurricular play a role, but I'm curious if medical admissions committees have these stats in the back of their mind. Oh, Lord. I like this one. I talk about this one all the time. So,
talk about it.
Dr. Scott Wright. If a medical school has a median, right, and I'm glad the student correctly said median, the MSAR shows median, not mean or average. If a medical school has a median, let's say, of a 3.96, as the student says, which is
would
ridiculous.
Not be true.
Yeah, that's not true. Anyway, yeah. Let's say it's a 3.8. Let's go 3.8 as a median GPA, and a student has a 3.6 GPA. Should they go, oh, I'm not good enough for this school?
No.
No, no. Easy, right? Half of the class has below a 3.8 GPA.
Exactly. That is the exact, and that's what I don't understand about this question is it uses this term median, and it's talking about this median, you know, of this magical, you know, median of 3.96, and then it says, at a disadvantage to applying to that school with a GPA below the median. Well, 50% of the people that got in were below the median. Yeah. So why on earth would you not apply there?
Yeah.
I just don't understand the question.
Yeah. So let me ask, I understand the question because I get it all the time and you do too. The question at the end of the day comes down to, especially students who are more limited in their funding in terms of how many schools they can apply to. And that's a whole different conversation about how ridiculous it is to charge per school, which is why I love TMDSAS, and it's just one flat fee, is how do I know if I have limited funds to apply to medical schools, right? And this is the flack that I get when I talk about don't use stats to apply to medical school, is students push back. I'm like, I can only apply to 5 schools, 10 schools, whatever it is. Yeah. I need to make sure I'm applying to schools where I have a chance. And that thought process alone in my mind just doesn't logically make sense, because assuming you have good stats, not amazing 4.0, 521 MCAT, but you have good stats, and we can't really define that for anyone, but assuming that, at the end of the day, we are lacking data. Scott, and you heard my talk about this in Toronto.
Yes.
Is medical schools don't publish their cutoffs. Not all medical schools publish their cutoffs. And schools have cutoffs. And they some will say we review all applications. And that just means we don't have cutoffs, but we're still going to rank them highest stats to lowest stats. And we may not get to yours, but if schools would publish over the course of 5 years, right, their concerns, the excuse that I got was, well, if we publish the lowest MCAT score from the class of 2024, everyone's going to know who that student is. And I'm like, well, that's pretty crappy that you would think that. How would you know? Be like, oh, it's the Brown student who got the lowest score. Like, who would think that? Like, how am I going to know out of a class of 200 people
who's got the lowest score?
The lowest score. It's ridiculous to think that unless someone is thinking in that obviously racist way that I just said it. It just doesn't make sense. And so maybe we publish, like, here's the last 5 years. Over the last 5 years, our average lowest MCAT score that we accepted was a 498 or was a 502, whatever that may be. And our average lowest GPA, science GPA, was a 3.2, right? That would give amazing detail into a process for students to go, okay, the average over the last 5 years, lowest science GPA was a 3.2. I have a 3.4. Their median is a 3.7. That means I probably have, I'm competitive
in the
enough
ballpark,
to still get a look. Let me apply.
Right.
And so I just, it pisses me off that schools are not more transparent about this process and come up with excuses as why they can't be, to the detriment of students, which is why we see average number of schools being applied to every year going up and up and up, schools benefit from that. AAMC benefits from that.
Yeah,
Liaison and Acomas benefit from that.
Yeah,
like it's a effed up process.
Yeah.
So here's what I want to chime in from a different lens, because I think I know. I mean, there's a lot of reasons students ask us these questions, but one of the reasons students fixate on stats is because if you were fortunate enough to have guidance in your college admissions process, you were told that this is the way it works, right? That you got to look at your SAT, ACT, and you got to look at your GPA, and you got to look at your class rank. And then that all of those things matter, not just to get in, but because colleges are also unfairly fixated with their U.S. News World Report ranking, right? So like
U.S.,
there's a reason that schools like Harvard will tell kids with 3.2 to apply. They may have a chance of getting in, but it's more about Harvard wants to be able to say they turn away 95% of the applicants. So they're happy to have people apply who aren't probably in league for the class that they're accepting that year, because they want to turn away a lot of people. And med schools don't play that game. I mean, there's a lot with the med school application process that I do think is unjust, or just honestly could just be more transparent, even if it is just, but they're not playing a rankings game like that. And that's where a lot of that data stuff comes from. So if, and again, I know people are asking this question from a lot of reasons, right? Maybe it's how many schools should I apply to? Maybe it's I'm looking for one that's a match. But the idea of match, right, if you're thinking safety, match, reach, doesn't really work like that with med school. Mm-hmm. There really are no safeties, for one thing.
Right.
And I don't think that there's a big distinguishing between match and reach in a process where about 40% of the people who apply get in. Like, everything's a little bit of a reach, and you just try anyway. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, we spent a lot of time kind of talking about why this process is unjust. What I want to remind anyone who's really fixated on the numbers is Ryan's advice is don't look.
Yep.
Just don't look at the numbers. My advice is if you have to look, look at the 10% cutoff.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's my advice.
Because at least then you're getting a what?
I said that's my advice too. If you have to, then look at the 10th percentile. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let me extend my rant. Just this is this is
I'll give you the spotlight.
Back up on the soapbox.
Oh, wait,
that's me. That's me. Okay.
There you go.
All right. I'm back up on my soapbox. So this is the explanation that I give, and it may completely be false, but it makes sense in my mind. Is if students are only looking at the MSAR for picking schools to apply to, and they go onto the MSAR and go, okay, I have a 3.8 GPA and a 515 MCAT score, and these are the schools that I'm going to apply to. And the other students who have 3.5s and 5.10s, these are the schools that I'm going to apply to, because this is what the MSAR is for. I'm going to pick my schools based on my stats. What, in theory, students are doing year in and year out is perpetuating the same stats year in and year out. When you only give schools the opportunity to accept and reject students within a given GPA range, because that's what the MSAR says, well, guess what the MSAR next year is going to say? It's going to have this same exact GPA and MCAT range. You're not giving the schools an opportunity to tell you yes or no. You are saying yes or no before that ever happens.
Yep. Yep. You are acting as your own admissions committee and saying no.
Yep.
Yeah. And what's, I mean, funny, like funny, sad, not funny, haha. What's funny about that is that one of the things we hear from you guys a lot is like, you feel sometimes like people in your life are telling you no, right? You know, if mm-hmm. you're frustrated with mentors or work supervisors or doctors, you know, or, you know, whoever who are saying, oh, you got those two C's, I don't know, or you're a full-time engineer, I don't know. Like, don't tell yourself no either.
Yep. All right. I'm off my soapbox. We can continue.
Okay. let's see where I lost my thread here.
Okay. That's a lot of good ones today.
Yeah. In short, I have an ample amount of teaching experience and absolutely want teaching to be a part of my career in medicine. After my clinical experience, I know I want to combine the best of both worlds, medicine and teaching. I'm a non-trad and know that my career goals are to go into academic medicine in some form. Should I be specific about my aspirations on my application? Scott, what do you think?
I think it would be beneficial to connect the two. But, you know, I think until you're into the environment of medical education and what that looks like, you may not know for sure, but I think from your vantage point early on in the process, I think that expressing how much you like teaching and maybe mentoring, and that you want that to be a part of your career, I think it makes a lot of sense to do that. That doesn't replace, obviously, clinical experience and et cetera in terms of what you want to have present in your application. But I think in terms of the personal statement, for example, or in the application itself, connecting all that together makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that you know, it's getting harder and harder to keep good students in academic medicine because it's just not as lucrative. as private practice or whatever. So academic medicine can be, you know, can be a bit of a challenge for students to see the benefit in terms of the bottom line on their budget, for example. But I think that if you know for sure that teaching is really important to you and you like it, and I say go for it.
Yeah, that kind of stuff can come through. I typically wouldn't recommend it for a personal statement, but that stuff can come through in the activity list where you're going to talk about teaching because that's what you've been doing for a while, and making a comment in there about your future as an educator in medicine, I think is an appropriate comment.
Yeah, and so, there are some secondary application essays which will ask about if you had to dream about your what your future would look like, you know, what do you anticipate that might be looking like, at least at this point in your progress. And so that is not a not common question in a secondary application, but it's not rare either. And so I think that, you know, that would be another place where that might come out.
Yeah. How is a patient transport aid viewed by medical schools? If I have the option to do scribing or transport, I assume scribing would give me better clinical experience.
Yeah. Generally, I would say, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I've heard from some students who have heard from medical schools that there are some medical schools out there that don't consider transport as clinical experience.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you can really control. I think some students will say, should I reach out to schools? I'm like, no, just mark it as clinical on your application and
let them do what they're going to do with it.
Hope they'll like it.
Yeah.
Well, and like we've said so many times with jobs that are sort of more entry level, take transport if that's the way to get the job and then see if you can shift.
Yeah. Parlay that into something different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that gives absolutely you good use of parlay.
I've definitely had plenty of people transport me who could have used more training. Like, and I just mean in like the basic stuff, like I sprained my ankle yet again and you just pushed my foot into the door. Ow. You know?
Why? So why
if you're one of the people who can
in?
Really steer me in a wheelchair and not knock me into things, I will let you a lot.
Well, I'm excited for the day when we have the Amazon warehouse robots that just slide under a stretcher, lift it up, and then just take you. Like, that's the future
wherever
of patient transport.
Yep, I agree. You're gonna have robots in the OR. Then why not robots transporting them from one place to another?
Yep, exactly. While inputting activities on MAPT, I found myself feeling uneasy listing, let alone describing relief or volunteer work. How would you recommend describing these experiences without sounding self-centered, prideful, all while not undermining the work itself?
Well, so I do have an opinion, a definite opinion about this question, because so I think in my experience, a lot of applicants fear coming across as arrogant or prideful, or what was the other word that they use in this, self-centered. And I think the chances of that happening are really low.
Yep.
In other words, I think if you're a relatively well-adjusted, centered, balanced person, and you're going to input the things that you're doing, and you're going to be talking about what you did. I mean, the application is all about you. Of course, it's going to be self-centered. It's all about you. But you're not going to, I mean, the chances of you coming across as prideful or arrogant are really low. And I think if you're, and my feeling is, if you're asking that question, then it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because you're self-aware, number one.
Yeah.
So just the fact that you're asking that question and that this is on your mind, you're not going to be coming across that way is my gut reaction is that I wouldn't worry about it. Just do the application, answer the questions, describe what you did, what you got out of those experiences. I really literally over the thousands of applications I reviewed over my 25 years in medical education, I would say I could count really very, very, very low numbers where I thought it came across as really, you know, kind of outrageous. So
yeah,
it's not going to happen.
And the other side is often concerning for students, is especially in a disadvantaged essay, is I don't want to feel like they need to pity me, right? It's kind of the opposite. Yeah. And it's the same response is, unless you are trying to get that sentiment across, then you're probably just fine.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
I don't know if this person literally meant in the activity section or if they meant like, I'm actually applying this year and I'm working on my official activities descriptions. But I just wanted to make that distinction, because especially if you're not applying this year and you're just sort of logging your activities as you go, that's the whole point of the reflection, is just brain dump. Yep. Don't even worry about how you sound. Just get it all down, because later you can go and look at, you know, those notes that are going to be way too long and way too rambly, and cut them down.
Yeah.
If you're worried about how it sounds, then I would say it out loud to a friend and turn on, you know, the Google Voice type to talk. So it'll type while you talk.
Yeah.
Because you'll be surprised how natural it will come out if you just talk it out.
Yeah.
Which, just a random thought that popped into my head. This is mapped. This is how map unfolds for everyone in real time. When you mentioned, right, just do a brain dump and don't think about it, I had this random thought that came across my mind when students are doing these random dumps in the activities section, or as with new updates, it'll be in your courses, it'll be as part of your MCAT score. You can have these reflection boxes and your courses. Did I say courses? You can have that in your reflection boxes. I think it'd be interesting to think about the ability to mark those as private, so that an advisor doesn't have access to some thoughts that a student may have.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I agree with that. Because that might cause a little bit of hesitation.
Yep.
To put things out there, just that dump mentality. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, if you guys want to comment, if that's interesting to you, if you'd like to be able to mark things private so that they're not visible when you give read-only access to your advisor, we'd be interested to know if you'd like that feature.
Yeah.
All right, we probably have time for one or two more.
Yeah, for sure.
After doing some research, future pun intended, I found that NIH grants are given out 800 times more often to MDs versus DOs. As I am interested in pursuing some research in medical school, is that enough reason to the question, why MD over DO? So here's where, let's use our research brain. Correlation doesn't equal causation.
Right.
The question is, if this is a true statement, which I don't know if it is, if the NIH truly does give out 800 times more often to MDs versus DOs, the question is why? Is it just MD because they're MDs versus DOs? We don't know, right? That's just what it says right there. What we do know is that DOs are still relatively new in the medical world. That there are far, far, far more MDs graduating every year than DOs. That MDs, the education has typically access to these big urban academic centers where research is usually being done. And so MD students are typically more exposed to research potentially. And
there's also more MD PhD dual programs than there are DO PhD dual programs.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. They take that exposure from medical school, the MD students do, and continue that forward in their career. But that's not to say that as a DO, if you are really interested in research, you can't go forge your own path and go get those grants too.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And I think that, you know, I think that, you know, you set your goals the way you set them. But I do think that you have to look when you're looking at the individual medical schools, whether it's DO or ND, you have to look at what are their values? What is their mission? What do they do at their institution? Where is their institution located? Is it within the context of a general academic institution, or is it a standalone and doesn't really have any connection to anything outside of medicine? So, for example, I think a couple of good examples for in the DO world are Michigan State and University of North Texas, where these are DO schools, but they're within the context of an academic health science center. They're within the context of the broader scope of what higher education is all about, which is, you know, one of those things is research, is what higher ed is all about. And so I think you have to look, drill down to the individuality of the medical schools, and matching your goals as a student and ultimately as a practitioner, and make sure that they match with the goals and the values and the mission of the institutions you're looking at. And just, you know, because I think in some cases you're right. You can look at an individual DO school and say this DO school is not, generally speaking, a big research institution. It's not doing a lot of stuff. It's not, you know, their focus is teaching, their focus is primary care, their focus is whatever. So, yeah.
As a quick addendum, so we sort of addressed the first part of this. The second part is that enough to answer the question, why MD over DO? And I don't know if you misheard us before. We were actually saying that why MD over DO is rarely ever asked.
Yeah.
DO over MD is sometimes asked, but if you think about often in culture with much thornier issues than allopathic versus osteopathic, the dominant group centers. So marginalized groups are forced to express themselves and dominant groups are sort of given a given. That's kind of the way it goes with MD-DO to some degree. Like there's an assumption that that's the norm. Now, I disagree with that assumption, but there are way more schools that are MD. Like you can't deny the numbers.
Yeah, right.
And
worldwide, you know, osteopathic medicine only exists in the United States at any education level. Right.
There are osteopaths in other countries, but they're more like chiropractors.
Right.
Like the way we use that word is different.
Right. Right. And so I think I agree with you completely, Rachel, on that.
Yeah.
Just a
extension of that point, Rachel. Mm-hmm. I don't like the term osteopath for that specific reason.
Right.
I prefer osteopathic physician.
Right.
Because osteopath is a career field in the rest of the world, which is basically like a chiropractor, physical therapist kind of person.
Yeah.
Our osteopaths are osteopathic physicians. And I got mad at CNN when they were talking about Trump's physician being an osteopath. I'm like, he's not an osteopath. He's an osteopathic physician, which it confuses people because then they go and look up what's an osteopath and they see, oh, it's not even a physician. Because they're looking at what the rest of the world calls an osteopath. So
yeah, I mean, in my mind, okay, so it's, you know, doctor of medicine, doctor of osteopathy, doctor. They're just doctors.
Yeah. Really.
When I see my DO doctors, usually I call my doctors by my first name because, you know, I want that kind of parity in my relationships. But if I'm calling them by their title, I just say doctor.
Yeah.
I don't care about the DO versus MD.
Yeah, and I think generally speaking, the general public doesn't care, and they just want to feel better.
Yep,
you know they're, and I would say chances are often the case, particularly when you're talking about urgent, you know, acute issues that they're not even going to know what. Whether you're a DO or an MD, they're just going to, you know, so yeah.
Yep. An extension of that question is I would like to see what the NIH grants are in the last 10 years, right? Is that 800 to one? Is that over the course of the lifetime, even before
DOs
existed?
Or is it, yeah, that'd be interesting to know. Can we do one more? I think that one about financial aid would be a great one to do.
Yeah, that's what I was going to put up. So our friend here forgot about the 400 character limit, so we're not going to be able to get it all, but we can get the bulk of the first question at least.
I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer this. I'm anxious about financial aid concerning medical schools. Specifically, is working a full-time and part-time job after college frowned upon in the sense that upon admission, a medical school may offer you a smaller financial aid package or deem you not qualified for financial aid. What has been your experience along these lines? I guess part two of this question is how full-time, part-time, clinical, and or research jobs are considered by something.
An admissions committee, yeah.
Yeah.
So I really like this question because I think this concerns a lot of students. And I think the point here, and the points that you made earlier, Rachel, contrasting undergraduate institutions with medical schools is applicable to this question as well. Mm-hmm. The financial aid picture for medical school students is so much different than it is for an undergraduate institution. An undergraduate, they don't typically, medical schools are not doing a whole lot of leveraging of financial aid to get, you know, these, you know, to get their class and stuff like that. I think that, you know, what you find in the medical school world is that there are different schools are going to have different ways that they allot financial aid. And when I say financial aid, there's different types of financial aid. There's institutional aid, scholarship, you know, such as scholarships or grants. And then there is federal, you know, or state aid. Some states have their own aid programs for medical school students or whatever. So, but what I want to say is that generally speaking, there is plenty of money to go around to go to medical school. Now, most of that money is going to be loan money for almost every student. If you don't have super rich parents that can finance this whole thing. Which, man, I wish, wouldn't that be great?
can they adopt me, please?
I know, right? But if you don't have, you know, a buttload of money sitting somewhere, then you're going to be taking out loans. You're going to be, and those loans, even the loans for medical school education are different than they are at the undergraduate level. You have a longer period of time for repayment. Often medical schools will try to lump a lot of their institutional aid into the first or second year, because that makes a difference in terms of when you're repaying the loans in terms of the amount of interest that you're paying on those loans. And so I think that what I get as a sense from this questioner is an uneasiness about, number one, am I going to be able to finance medical school education? And then, and yes, the answer is yes. If you're a citizen, a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, then you're going to be able to finance your medical education. Now, the other part of this question is about, if I work really hard and save up a whole bunch of money to be able to help me pay for medical school, is that going to affect how much? And the answer is really no. Yeah. It's not going to affect it at any, you
it's
know,
not need-based at any, at all.
Yeah, it's really not need-based at all. It's what they're really looking for is, how do we get these kids through medical school? And so I think this is a good question. It's an important question. But for this particular question, I would say, don't worry about that. If you're in my advice to all of you guys that are listening to this podcast or watching this video or certainly live now, is in preparing for medical school, save as much money as you can. Pay off as much debt as you can before you get to medical school. Watch out for credit cards, and then that's what you can do. That's, you know, that's what is a great deal for you.
Yeah.
And I remember last year at National Pre-Med Day, we had
Travis
Hornsby from Student Loan Planner, and he was talking about making decisions that help you save money. And he's worked with paying off debt for a lot of people who have MDs and GDs. And his rationale was pay close attention to where you live and what you drive and don't worry about anything else. So like yep. you may have to suck it up and get a roommate or even the two or three roommates. Mm-hmm. You may have to drive a crappy used Corolla. I love my used Corolla. I have a Prius now. I gave my used Corolla to my nephew. Now he's driving it, but I love that thing. But other than that, he was like, if you want the Starbucks, get the Starbucks. If you want the new backpack, if you need the new laptop for school, like just buy it. Right. But he was like, just, you know, save in those two big areas if you can.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that attitude to me makes a lot of sense because you work so hard. Little luxuries can go a long way to making you feel better on a daily, weekly basis. But
yeah,
you got to save at the big places.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, folks, cool. That is all we have.
Yeah, it's all for today. Wow.
All right. There you have it. Great Q&A. Again, if you want more episodes like this, go subscribe to Ask the Dean in your favorite podcast player of choice, or go subscribe at mapped.tv. That's MAPPD.TV. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on the Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.